WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
On the issue of Jack Welch, since he's the focus of the Wizards of Money episode, you actually had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Welch at the last shareholders meeting that was held in Atlanta in April of 2001. And can you describe, first of all, who you went? I'm assuming that you're not a GE shareholder.
No, I'm not a GE shareholder.
Okay, but you got to go to the shareholders meeting. So can you describe how you got to go to the shareholders meeting and what happened when you got there?
I was invited to speak at a press conference before the shareholders meeting across the street from it by a shareholder group who's concerned about the Hudson. They had brought an issue forward as shareholders. They wanted GE to disclose publicly how much in advertising dollars they had spent to fight the dredging of the Hudson. And I gave my story at the press conference before the meeting. And they were all on their way over to the meeting, and they were impressed with what I had to say in my story. They also wanted to bring some relevance to Georgia since the meeting was being held in Georgia. So they invited me to come with them as a guest, which I was very flattered and immediately agreed to do with some trepidation, knowing that I would be walking into the lion's den. And they put the little badge on me, and we started walking into the room, bypassing all of the people that I had been dealing with in Rome, Betsy Weltner, the public relations person, Gary Sheffer, all of them, their eyes getting bigger and bigger. What are you doing here? The meeting began, and when their issue came forward, one of the nuns kind of nudged me and said, okay, go talk at the microphone. And I stood up and went to one of the two microphones in this room full of thousands of people at the Atlanta Civic Center. And brought my question forward, which was along the lines of, Jessica Lindberg, I'm a housewife in Rome, Georgia, and where you had a plant, and is Rome facing the same 25-year battle that has been fought in the Hudson to get our community cleaned up? And there was silence and then immediate applause from the audience, which was overwhelming and very affirming for me that other people could see that this issue as simply.
Was there applause from Jack Welch as well?
There was not applause from Jack Welch, but he did look up and acknowledge me, which is a big step because he didn't do that with a lot of people, and said that he was very concerned, that GE was very concerned about Rome, and that they were doing everything they could.
And when he spoke about what GE was doing in Rome, was his statistics accurate?
No, not entirely. No.
Okay.
But, of course, there's no way to get. In fact, one of the things he said was that GE had spent $25 million in the Rome community cleaning up PCBs, and that didn't sound right to me. And I asked Richard Lester, who's the plant manager at GE, when we got home the next week, to give me those numbers, if he could provide any sort of information on how much they'd spent. And he said, of course, that they couldn't, that was confidential.
They could not tell you how much they'd spent.
Right.
I found it interesting that the only Atlanta news outlet that covered this issue to any extent and that wanted to interview you was the 11 Alive TV news, which is an NBC station, and NBC obviously is owned by GE. Do you find that at all peculiar that it's only the NBC station that wanted to cover this issue?
I did it first, and then after extensive talking to the reporter who did the coverage and also my father, who's in the media business as well, I didn't have any worries about it at all. I didn't think they were related. I don't think that anybody at GE pays any attention to what they're doing at this small, local level,
right.
Except for after the fact. She didn't seem to give it two thoughts.
Okay.
But also, Creative Loafing did do a story on
the story to hit the national press recently was the Washington Post article on Monsanto. The interesting thing in that article was the discussion of when Monsanto knew that PCBs were a probable carcinogen and they cause all kinds of environmental damage. And it seems that they had a committee, Monsanto itself had a committee that was set up in 1969 that actually recommended Monsanto phase out the use of PCBs at that point. But interestingly, they found some Monsanto documents that said that GE pressured Monsanto to keep producing PCBs because they needed it in their own business. And also the article mentions that Monsanto was sending all of its customers, including GE, warnings about the use of PCBs, and this was going back to the 60s. You talked about how employees brought Pyrenol home. Was this, do you know, is this during the 60s and 70s as well as before that?
I believe it was, because the plant didn't open until 53.
Okay.
So I believe that they were still taking the Pyrenol home during the 60s. I don't know how far into the 70s.
Okay.
I think it was up until 77,
until they stopped using PCBs.
Right.
What happened to the plant? Is it still in operation?
Not as a transformer plant, no. Mostly as offices, I think. They have about...
Why don't they just close offices. It down?
What I've heard is that if they closed it down, the EPD would immediately require everything be cleaned up. And that's why, as long as they keep it open and keep a few people working there, they can clean it up on their timetable rather than EPD's timetable.
Okay. Well, what happened to the jobs? I mean, does GE, as I understand it, still produces transformers? Did they set up another factory somewhere else?
In Mexico.
Okay. When did they move them? When did they move all the transformer production to Mexico? Do you remember?
I think it was 94, 95.
Okay, so like right that. After NAFTA
right.
came in. So
right.
they didn't waste
right.
any time.
No.
Okay.
No.
The Georgia Environmental Protection Division is part of Georgia state government. How have they behaved throughout this? I've seen in some of the public comments that people have been saying that they've been quite eager to please GE. Is that generally how they've acted? Or
I don't think that's a fair characterization of the people who work there, but I do think it's a fair characterization of the way our system works.
Right.
The people that we worked with on a day basis to get this cleaned up are just outraged and frustrated by how long it's taking and how little they can do, but they just don't have any money and very few resources and people that they need to be able to clean it up the way they want to.
It's interesting, because I know what it's like to work on issues where you have to deal with the Georgia state government, especially on environmental issues, and to a large extent it's got a lot of the characteristics of the old boys network, and that's a feature of the South. I think it's very interesting that a very influential person in Georgia, ex-Senator Sam Nunn, who was a senator for many years in Georgia, is also on the board of GE and has been on the board since 1994. Do you have any feel for whether that's been an influence on how the state's reacted to this particular problem?
I don't know. That would be pure speculation.
Okay.
I don't know how it could have been except for the old boy.
You haven't seen any evidence of it?
No, we've not heard his name anywhere.
Okay. Anytime.
There was a story about a lawyer who was working both sides of the case, who had Harold Rehises as the director of the EPA, EPD, Harold Rehises' ear on the water talks, but she was also a GE lawyer on this issue.
She was working for the EPA and for GE?
EPD and GE.
Okay.
Yes, I think...
On the issue of Sam, and I know, again, this is pure speculation, but he is a senior partner at King & Spalding, and now King & Spalding has been Monsanto's lawyer representing them on a lot of these chemical issues, and so I find it interesting that, you know, he's also on the board of GE, which has similar chemical problems. In the case of the Hudson, the EPA stepped in, the federal body stepped in and demanded the dredging. Why hasn't the EPA stepped in on this issue? What's the mechanism of how that works, do you know?
For as long as possible, the EPA will allow the state to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
For as long as the state is getting cooperation from GE and GE is fulfilling the state requirements, the EPA must stay out of it.
Okay.
They cannot get involved.
Mm-hmm.
And GE has been very careful about just doing what the state mandates.
That was part of the interview I did with Jessica Lindbergh of Citizens Action Network in Rome, Georgia. After this interview, I did some more research into the Atlanta lawyer working for both the EPD on water issues and representing GE on the Rome PCB issue. This lawyer was mentioned in the interview with Jessica Lindbergh. I found this lawyer is from none other than King and Spalding, also mentioned in the interview, and, of course, Sam Nunn's law firm. The name of the lawyer in question is Patricia Barmeyer, and before joining King and Spalding, she worked as the Assistant Attorney General for the very same state of Georgia. Ms. Barmeyer of King and Spalding does indeed represent GE in fighting the EPD and EPA decisions about the Rome, Georgia situation. And yes, she also works as a key advisor to the state of Georgia's EPD on critical water issues for the state. Oh yes, and King and Spalding also represented GE in squashing two class action lawsuits against them for the dumping of PCBs in Rome, Georgia. So I stand corrected in what I said in the interview. It's not an old boys network after all. There's some old girls in it too. We're going to end this edition of Wizards by talking about science, the well-capitalized way. With all these environmental problems, GE has entered the business of funding medical studies in a big way. Miraculously, even though there are numerous studies finding a link between PCBs and serious health problems in animals, all the GE-funded medical studies find that humans and PCBs get along just fabulously. Let's hear some of Jack's medical words of wisdom.
Why doesn't a rational mind come to the conclusion that the risk is practically lower than breathing? Never mind that eating fish from the river has been banned for 2 decades, or that PCB levels in the water and fish have fallen 90% since 1977. More than 20 studies, most completely independent of GE, show no link between PCBs and cancer. At the end of the day, what happens in rats does not happen in humans when both are exposed to PCB.
In response, let's hear some more from Jessica Lindbergh about the scientific studies in a world of scarce financial capital.
Actually, just so that people have an idea of geographic relationships, how far is Rome from Anniston, Alabama?
2 hours, maybe.
Okay.
I don't know.
it's not that far. It's
no.
Maybe 100 miles
right,
or so.
Right, right, right.
And obviously the people of Anniston have brought these lawsuits against
right.
Monsanto.
Mm-hmm.
Why have you not yet brought any kind of class action lawsuit? Is it the whole evidence thing?
It's the evidence.
The problem for you is not having access to the financial capital to perform the studies that
that
need to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the health studies? There's a doctor in Emory University who's worked a lot with you, and I know there's this blood testing that's going on other people here. Can you talk about that?
Dr. Frumkin worked with Citizens Action Network and several other leaders of the community to put together what we thought was just a really great way to study the PCB numbers in the community,
mm-hmm.
and gave it to the health department, and the health department has been trying to seek funding for it for probably about 6 months now.
And then in terms of studying cancer, I mean, I guess there's no studies of the particular types of cancer or the particular areas that you've been talking about that are affected to either prove or disprove, you know.
That's been the problem all along, is lack of information both from a health perspective and from an environmental perspective.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have the money to fund to find out the information, to get the answers we want, and GE has all the money in the world to keep it from happening.
To perform studies as well, that miraculous.
To take the questions results. That we want answered and find their own answer and say, you don't even have to do this study because we've already answered the
right.
question.
What do you see as the future of this problem? Where do you see it going?
I can't say that have a lot of optimism for it. I think it's going to continue the way it's been going. I think it's going to continue for another 25 years, and we might have one landfill cleaned up, but that it's going to be a long, long, slow process unless more information suddenly appears that could give us some answers.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.
So, while government bodies can somehow find taxpayers' contributions available for hundreds of millions in what we called expropriation compensation, no government body can find the resources for a health study desired by the taxpayers. Never mind. After all, in Jack's words, it's just a game. That's all for Wizards of Money Part 9. Please note that the Wizards of Money has a website where you can get the text of all episodes of Wizards and find more information. The website is located at www.wizardsofmoney.org.
What of those jobs that have left America for foreign lands? What's it like to work there for those people? Organizations like the WEF claim they are helping impoverished people in other countries by bringing them economic development. Here's what Bengali workers who recently visited the Bangor area had to say.
Shubho shondha, ami Janu Akhtar, amar boyosh 22. Jokhon amar boyosh 12,
Good evening. I am Janu Akhtar. I'm 22 years old. When I was 12, I had to work because my family was very poor and I had to leave my school after the fourth grade. Since then, I have been working for the last 10 years in garment factories and I have to work 13 to 14 hours and sometimes 19 to 20 hours. Now I work for Actor Sports where I make these caps for many universities in the United States and I do the stitching on the visors of these caps. In my factory, on a production line, there are 30 machines with 30 sewing operators and 10 helpers. In my factory, the supervisors give us the target that we must have to produce 375 pieces of caps like this, but we can barely produce 320. So we are always under pressure and we are asked to go faster. And to do so, sometimes we make mistakes. Then the supervisor hit us, slap us, jab with scissors, and sometimes they hit us with shoes.
আমি বেতন পাই 965 টাকা ঘন্টা পরে 8 সেন্স এক মাসে পরে
I make a monthly wages that is 965 Bangladeshi taka that's equivalent to 8 cents per hour or $16.31 per month. When Charlie asked me what I thought the price of a cap was, I thought it would cost 15 Bangladeshi taka that's equivalent to 26 cents only. But later I learned that it cost $17 or $18, that is more than I make in a whole month.
Those were Bengali workers speaking in Bangor, Maine, last year. Thanks to Radioactive for that tape. Neither General Electric, nor the Disney Corporation, or any of the free trade slave masters are isolated cases of villainy. They reflect what author George Drafin calls the corporate consensus. Drafin is with the Seattle-based Public Information Network, which was formed to provide research services and training to citizens who are working for corporate and governmental accountability and who are committed to socially just and ecologically sustainable societies. Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters in Seattle spoke with Drafin about his new book, The Corporate Consensus, A Guide to the Institutions of Global Power.
Your book, it's got an interesting title. Can you tell us about the book and why you felt the need to write it?
I was contacted by some folks after the WTO protests here in Seattle, as they saw other campaigns and protests focus on, say, the Democratic and Republican political conventions. And they felt that the energy and the education and the focus that had come up during the WTO was being lost by a return to looking at conventional politics. And they wanted a guide to the institutions of global power. And so we, through a process of elimination, we came up with a half a dozen think tanks and a half a dozen lobby groups and a half a dozen international financial institutions and a half a dozen political forums, and wrote profiles to those basically as a public education tool.
Okay, and I understand all those different groups you came up with all work together towards one big picture.
Well, some of them work directly together. Many of them have interlocking boards of directors. Many of them have a revolving door between their staff and congressional staff or lobby groups. So many of them do work together. Many other ones are not directly related, but they tend to work towards the same things. And that's where the corporate consensus idea came about. There are a half dozen principles that all these groups are working towards, which is to privatize public resources and externalize corporate costs, to control information, centralize political authority and economic power, removing barriers to trade. So the groups are all working together. They have an unspoken consensus in many cases, but they're still working towards the same goals.
Okay, and so would we call, I guess using the word conspiracy would be way too strong. Would collusion be a all right word to use in describing their working relationship?
Conspiracy, collusion, those are loaded words. The groups often work explicitly together. Sometimes they merely have the same goals, and so they're headed in the same direction. Collaboration, certainly, lobby groups and political groups form associations, and there's a number of those listed in the profiles. Used to be industry associations were the big thing. The steel manufacturers would get together, or advertising industry companies would get together and push their political agenda in Washington. Nowadays, it's more a global trade. So there are organizations that exist to take contributions from corporations and then lobby for international trade laws and deregulation of international trade that benefits all their members. Whether it's a conspiracy or not, I think is really based on whether you know what's going on. If you read the news and you educate yourself about these things, then it doesn't seem so secret. What's impressed me over the years is actually how open all of this stuff is. And it does take time, and it takes certain education, I guess, in going through news sources or spending time on the internet. But the information is there if you take the time. And once you learn about these things, they don't seem so secret anymore. What's really impressive is how open it is and how society at large seems to actually collaborate along with the corporations and the organizations.
And in fact, I believe you do actual trainings with different groups to show them how they can find this information. Is that right?
I do research and writing. Some things like the Corporate Consensus book are published. Many other things are done as background information for nonprofit groups that are doing campaign work and need information for those. And that's actually how the Corporate Consensus was written, for a group of activists that wanted a tool for public education.
All right, so we'll be giving out your contact information at the end of the half hour. So can you give me some examples of how economic, legal, and political mechanisms work together to create and maintain corporate power?
Yes, power is the ability to make decisions. It's the ability to control agendas, political agendas. It's the ability to allocate economic resources. It's the ability to in a certain cultural or social sense of influencing the way people think and see things. And the cultural and legal and economic and political are so interlocked that it's really an artificial exercise to try to separate them. Maybe an example is the way to look at it. Political elections in this country are heavily influenced by money. Most of that money comes from corporations or from industry associations. So the political process is influenced by economic power, and after a few generations of that going on, it's in the social mind that that's the way things should be. So culturally and socially, we may object to some of the worst abuses of it. There may be some illegal cases where people disapprove. But in the general public mind, there's a certain acceptance, if not approval, of corporate money in politics. So you have economic and political and legal power combining with a social sense of how things should be. And that adds up to money, corporate money in politics. And when you try to have political campaign finance reform, it's met with dismissal or co-optation, or laws may actually be written, but there's so many loopholes in them that they again give the public a sense that something's been done, some reform has taken place, but in actuality, things have been cemented into law. And that's actually how the political action committees and current campaign finance laws were set up to be reforms after the Watergate scandal. So clearly things have gotten worse instead of better, and that's one of the functions of law is to enact regulatory schemes that give the appearance of reform and democracy and equity when actually they do the opposite.
Yeah, I think law is one of the things that the POCLAD organization focuses a lot on in their recent visit to Seattle. They talked about that. Media plays a big part in as one of the mechanisms, doesn't it?
It does. It's the main source of information for most of the public. What little news the average person actually absorbs is probably coming from network television. All three of the big national networks, four national networks, are owned by corporations, three of which don't really have, news and education are not their main purpose. And in fact, the free press and news organizations still have an aura of public education and public interest to them, when in fact they're really advertising and public relations corporations. Their income and their ability to exist comes from advertising, which is corporate money. So it has little to do with public education anymore. And I'm often amused by people who are shocked that the New York Times or NBC would not cover a controversial political issue, as if the New York Times or NBC were nonprofit public education organizations, which clearly they're not.
And the control of the media is also convenient for keeping things like your fine book here out of off the New York Times bestseller list, where in fact it seems like it should be something that would be in everyone's home, right there next to, let's say, the dictionary or encyclopedia or whatever.
Yeah, well, there's a little reverse psychology there, I guess. If this kind of book were on the bestseller list, there'd be no need to write it, because the people would be educated and be active in politics, and people would be primarily living as citizens rather than as consumers. So the book has sold a couple thousand copies, which is actually pretty good for a self-published a book that's been distributed in conferences and by word of mouth. And it's probably getting into the hands of the people that are most interested in it. It's also on my internet site, so people can stumble upon it when they're on the internet.
Let's tell me what that site is now, and we'll bring that up again at the end of the show.
It's endgame.org, E-N-D-G-A-M-E.org.
All right. Now, one of the sections you have in here is police and military power, the ultimate weapon. How do they figure into all this?
Well, there's a continuum upon which power rests. Concentrated power that's been in power for a long time, say several generations, is basically a cultural and social power. It becomes insinuated into people's thinking and attitude and worldview until people don't even recognize that it's taking place. And that would be in the realm of the media, in the realm of corporations and industries being involved in public education, in foundations and think tanks that fund nonprofit organizations that are presumably working for social reform. When the social and cultural aspects of power don't work, legal and political power is brought to bear. Informal or difficult to trace power, such as lobbying and political influence buying, takes place, but also a revolving door between corporate staff and congressional staff. Formal and informal advisory groups that are made up largely of industry. But many of the laws that are passed nowadays are actually written by corporate lobbyist law firms on corporate lobbyist letterhead and given directly to congressional representatives who introduce those bills. There's also economic power, which ranges from mergers and cartels, control of oil or control of minerals or control of forest resources, and free trade agreements and development agencies and multilateral development banks where taxpayer subsidies are given to corporations. And ultimately, corporate power is backed up by the police and the military. We can see that happening now in the Middle East. Some of the conspiracy theorists think that a single pipeline in Afghanistan is the real reason behind the bombing there. It's actually much worse than that. There's about a dozen pipelines planned coming out of Central Asia and going down through the Middle East and into Europe. And that influences military and security power over generations, not just this year or next year. But it also works on a local scale where more police are located in the less affluent parts of town. Minority groups are targeted for arrest and conviction and punishment to a much greater degree than more affluent groups. The government provides political risk insurance, and armies actually will move in if corporations are nationalized. So the range of corporate power goes from cultural and social power, which is invisible, to the most visible source of power, which is the police and military.
All right. For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with George Drafin, who is with the Public Information Network and author of The Corporate Consensus, A Guide to the Institutions of Global Power. George, the second half of your book, actually it seems to make up the bulk of your book, is examples of the different organizations that profiles of different organizations that make up this whole consensus. And I'm wondering if you can tell us about some of the more interesting ones that stand out in your mind.
Well, we took, I think there are 20 some profiles in the book, and we, what we tried to do was take a representative sample of four or five different categories of organizations. Some of them are industry associations. Some of them are trade and economic promotion groups like the International Chamber of Commerce. Some are think tanks like RAND, started during the Vietnam War to help with military and security analysis. And is still involved in that, but also in economic and development analysis. Some of the foundations, such as the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Hoover Institution. The Hoover Institution is connected with the Stanford campus. And also some of the financial institutions like the World Bank and International Monetary Fund and the U.S. Federal Reserve. So it's a wide-ranging group of organizations, but we tried to cover the gamut of organizations that together, collectively, promote corporate power. Some of them are old-time organizations like the Bilderberg or the Trilateral Commission that have been around for, 30 years or more, and others are quite new. Some of the Transatlantic Business Dialogue, where North American and European corporations work together to promote free trade and economic development. And some of them are groups or organizations that have been around for a while, like the United Nations, that you wouldn't expect to be promoting corporate power. But when you actually look at what's gone on over the last 10 or 15 years, they clearly are. Their mandate and mission remains the same, but the actual work they do, the standing committees they have, the people that are influential in those organizations has shifted over the past generation until NATO, United Nations, and other groups that you would think would be more neutral governance organizations are actually promoting corporate power.
Now, that's interesting, especially looking at what is currently happening in Afghanistan, that NATO and the United Nations now have, can we say, heavy investments in the corporate view of things. Since they're big players, since a lot of the justification the U.S. said for bombing in Afghanistan was because NATO backed it.
Yeah. The same can be, said with United Nations. It's a multilateral organization. And so, you can make an argument that anything they do is approved of by the world community. But when you actually look at who controls the organizations, the United States and its European allies clearly have the upper hand, particularly with NATO. I mean, it's explicitly a European and North American security organization, but the United Nations, too, through the Security Council and the World Bank as well. The World Bank voting influence is based explicitly on how much money you contribute to the bank, which gives the United States and a handful of countries in Europe the complete control of the policy and decision making at the World Bank.
So then the would it be fair to say, and I realize you're not necessarily international expert on different countries, but Argentina currently in an upheaval because of World Bank loans and requirements. Would it be fair to say then one of the real countries responsible would be the United States for their situation?
Well, certainly the United States has influence there. United States could influence the World Bank and IMF to restructure loans. I do shy away from the conspiracy theory that there's one or two people in the World Bank or one or two people in the United States government that have it in for Argentina. Just as in the United States, a recession comes and people feel the pain. Some of those people are poor. Some of those people are unemployed. And so, their pain is real. Their suffering is real. But, there's middle class and upper class people that can't go shopping every day like they did last year or the year before. And so they think they're feeling pain, too. But, we're all responsible for what happens. Argentina or any economic crisis is a complex thing, and no one or two people or even one or two economic forces or trends is going to be responsible for that crisis. It's an interlocked system, and so is the solution. You could abolish the World Bank tomorrow, and if everything else was in place the way it is today, something else would take its place very quickly. That's the difficulty with political reform. That's the difficulty with throwing the bums out of office. I've been around long enough to see the radicals, you know, think that Richard Nixon was the problem, and then Ronald Reagan was the problem, and now George Bush is the problem. So clearly, it's not who sits in the office; it's a structural problem of the office itself and how that's set up and how it's influenced.
All right. Looking at the first profile that you have in Profiles in Corporate Power, the American Enterprise Institute. I find that interesting because I watch off and on the Lehrer NewsHour, which is PBS version of the news. And I think probably the people they turn to the most as their experts on how the world works are members of the American Enterprise Institute. Could you talk about them?
The American Enterprise Institute has been around since World War II, and it was its mission, as most of these organizations, is very broad, very you can hardly argue with it. Individual freedom, responsibility, strengthening the foundations of a free society. But when you actually look at who's there, The trustees are dominated by corporate and government insiders. Dick Cheney was there. Motorola, American Express, Enron, Alcoa, Dow Chemical, and some of the great scholars and thinkers that they promote are people from National Security Council, the Trilateral Commission, and some of the other conservative or well, it's not conservative. I like to get away from conservative and liberal because some of these think tanks are quite liberal, but they're also pushing corporate power. Corporate power goes beyond liberal and conservative, which is one of the reasons it's so insidious. But the American Enterprise Institute is, like many of the groups here, is a tax-exempt nonprofit organization with lots of income, much of it coming from corporations. And they get the usual government subsidy by being tax free, and they're dominated by corporate executives and pushing a corporate agenda, but they're in the guise of a nonprofit think tank that's simply promoting debate and inquiry. When you actually look at their products, they're uniformly based on free trade and uniformly kind of confuse capitalism with democracy. There's the rigorous inquiry and debate that they talk about is actually a mishmash of economic and political systems, which shifts a little bit from decade to decade depending on what the rhetoric is. But they push deregulation, economic development, and free trade at the expense of nearly everything else.
Confusing capitalism with democracy, that actually sounds like a public relations campaign that's been going for quite a while now.
And completely embedded in our social thinking. I mean, you hear it every day on the radio, and it hardly even registers anymore. But when you think about it, it's comparing an economic system with a political system, and it's apples and oranges, but it's been repeated so often that even someone who's critical of the idea and its implications hardly notices it when it's mentioned.
Yeah, I think they're trying to work it into our gene pool, so we'll pass it on to generations to come. You mentioned that there are liberal or what's perceived as liberal groups that support the corporate consensus. Can you tell us what some of those are?
Brookings Institution might be the most well-known one. It's even older than the American Enterprise Institute. Brookings was created in 1916, again by a group of business leaders and academics. the leader of it, one of the founder of it, was a timber and mining executive who later served on the War Industries Board. And it was actually founded to provide the expertise to help restructure government agencies so that they would be operated as corporations are. They would use modern business methods to, you know, promote administrative competence and government efficiency was the way it was explained. But it was actually to privatize government and to make government mirror corporate attitudes and goals. Brookings supported the Marshall Plan after World War II, and since then it's gone back and forth with a liberal and conservative reputation and staff based on kind of the prevailing political winds in society. In the 1960s, it had a reputation as a liberal think tank, but the income was coming from Rockefeller and Ford Foundation and corporate grants. In the mid-1980s, Brookings kind of positioned itself back into the center of the political spectrum, and all the while calling for budget cutbacks and corporate competitiveness and national security. By the 1990s, Brookings was promoting market-based incentives to replace regulation and promoting increases in military spending. So it's a kind of a chameleon that goes with the prevailing political attitudes, but it's also promoting, underlying that rhetoric and that reputation, it's promoting the same things for the last 80 years.
All right, very quickly, since we only have a few minutes left, didn't really surprise me, but I think would be surprising to some people is a couple of the groups you have listed here. For instance, the Bilderberg and the Trilateral Commission are real groups. I think we tend to hear those from what I'll call the conspiracy theorists, and since the theories associated with them are so far out, you tend to just assume that this is all made up. But in fact, these are real organizations.
Yeah, the problem with conspiracy theorists is that they're actually thinking too small. The conspiracy theorists get all paranoid thinking that the Rockefeller family runs the Bilderbergs, which controls the world. And actually, the problem is much broader than that. When the United Nations and the Brookings Institution and the Chamber of Commerce and the World Bank and the American Enterprise Institute are all working towards the same things, you actually have a much bigger problem. And when society at large is buying into that and not able to imagine any other political or social agenda than what's being handed out by the corporate media, you have a much bigger problem. There are 20,000 murders each year on the streets, and people are worried about street crime. But there's 30,000 deaths from consumer products, and there's 100,000 deaths each year from occupational disease, and 10,000 deaths each year from industrial accidents. So especially people in the middle and upper classes are not aware of that. But you talk to somebody in the working class, and they know somebody who's been killed or gotten cancer from something on the job. And so the fact that we put up with that and the statistics just become abstract and we accept all that is the real conspiracy. We're all conspiring to allow the status quo to continue. And of course, when that happens, the people who are ruthless and willing to exercise power and seize power will end up on top.
That was George Drafin of the Public Information Network. For more info, you can contact George Drafin on the web at www.endgame.org, endgame.org, or call area code 206-723-4276, 206 723-4276. Copies of the book are available through his website. Thanks to Mike McCormick of KEXP in Seattle for that tape. And for more information on the protests in New York City this coming weekend against the World Economic Forum, visit www.anotherworldispossible.com. Anotherworldispossible.com.
Now, there's a lot of folks here who have lost their jobs.
As usual.
They had their corporations send their jobs overseas. Some had their company downsized them. And I think us standing here right now shows that we're not going to be quiet about it, are we? No! And I think the most important thing is they want to keep us quiet, but more important than that is they want to keep us divided. And are we going to let them divide us?
No!
This is our theatrical group here. We're going to do a little street theater. The year is 2002. Imagine we are in Washington, D.C., just after the September 11th tragedy. It has just been announced that there will be big layoffs at the airline companies and thousands of people will lose their jobs. Airline corporations are in trouble. Thousands of workers are in trouble. Airline corporations need money fast and thousands of laid off workers need help fast. But wait, we know there's the hoops we gotta jump through to get help. The big bureaucracy hoop. The unemployment office hoop. The U.S. Congress hoop. The federal government hoop. And the insurance company hoop. Who will get help? And how? Wait, here comes the airline corporations. And they're requesting billions of dollars of relief. And whoosh!
The planes are going through the hoops.
They fly through the hoops in record speed, and in about 15 minutes, they get $15 billion! Way to go, corporations! Next, we got Pat McCoy. Pat McCoy, Pat's a laid-off worker from Costigan Mill. He is representing 140,000 laid-off airline workers, and they are requesting quick relief, help to get health insurance, extended unemployment benefit. And what's that? Patty, you trying to get through the...
Help! Help! Help!
Help! Help! Come on, come out! They can't get through the hoops!
The unemployed worker can't make it through the hoops that the planes went through easily.
To whom do we owe this feeling of dread and hostility that incarcerates us all? A foolish question, you say? Tell that to the thousands of workers in the Bangor area that no longer have a job, and you might receive a response not to your liking. Do the remaining jobs in the Bangor area offer a livable wage, affordable medical benefits, or for that matter, anywhere near 40 hours work? Sadly, the answer is in nearly every case is no. On the back of many a proud worker and out of your hard-earned taxes, many a foreign aid program or rebuilding project for some disadvantaged country has been funded. So here we are today, you, the workers that are the very base of our existence as a country, are being thrown scraps. Scraps that have most, if not all, substance torn away. To now be considered disposable by the very country we so dearly love is at best intolerable. It is quite evident that the Republican members of our delegation, Senator Collins and Snow, have shortchanged the state of Maine and its people. Within weeks after the tragedy of 9/11, Congress passed a $15 billion bailout of the airline industry, but nothing, and I say nothing, for the 140,000 laid-off airline personnel. It is clear that the golden parachutes have been packed and distributed to the CEOs. The safety nets for we, the workers, have yet to be made. Thousands of families have had little to nothing for Christmas. Their homes are colder than normal, and their meals are smaller and further apart than years past. These workers are having the very essence of their soul torn away by an unabashed administration and their colleagues. Senators, how about some real help rather than more of your infamous political rhetoric and photo ops? I'd like to close by saying, if you hear anything at all
of what I said here today, please speak up. Let people know what you want. Let them know how you feel. Let them know you still have a voice. Thanks.
What's your name? Where are you from, my friend?
Pat McCoy, Costigan.
Pat McCoy from Costigan.
Event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by